Welcome to Pardes Daily, where you get your daily dose of Torah with Pardes faculty. This month, Pardes is bringing Elul to you. Let's dive in.
Hi, this is Rachel Berkovitz coming to you from Jerusalem. This is Unit 16 of 20, in which we're learning through all the Mishnayot of Masechet Rosh Hashanah. This week, we're starting the fourth and final chapter of the tractate. Woohoo! We've made it a long way. We're almost at the end. This chapter is going to cover a number of issues that seem to be disparate and not linked, but obviously, as we unpack it and unfold it, we're going to see that the parts are really bringing to us a deeper message and understanding. We saw in chapter 3 that the Mishnah made reference when talking about the shofar, that the shofar of Rosh Hashanah was equivalent to the shofar of Yovel, of the Jubilee year, with regard to both the blast, the tikiot, and the brachot, and the blessings, i.e. the prayer service, which we hadn't learned anything about. In this chapter, we're going to see a discussion of the Seder brachot, the order of the blessings, and the Seder tikiot, the order of the blasts. So that's foreshadowing that we saw in chapter 3 is going to be looked at more in depth here in chapter 4. Also, a number of issues that we saw in chapter 1 are going to be discussed here. One, in chapter 1, we saw about the relationship between Rosh Hashanah and Shabbat, and that the Edim, the witnesses, could transgress Shabbat to come and bring, maybe it's not Rosh Hashanah, the Kiddush HaChodesh, to say the new moon for the months in general, and obviously then also for Rosh Hashanah. And so we're going to see that come up here. We're going to see a little bit, as we saw in every taste of things that really talk about the opposite topic, even though we're really focusing on Rosh Hashanah, we're going to see a discussion of the Edim, the witnesses, and Kiddush HaChodesh being revived here. And we're also going to have a large section that's going to talk about the relationship between the time of the temple and the time post-destruction, right? That we already saw in chapter 1, where we were informed that there's differences in the way the messengers went out when the temple was standing and post-temple destruction. And we saw already that certain decrees were made to deal with challenges. This chapter is going to look at a whole bunch of decrees made by Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai post-destruction. We saw in chapter 2 the mention of different decrees that were mentioned to try to deal with the other groups of Jews that existed that there was tensions with. So we're going to see a number of these themes being repeated throughout. When you look at chapter 4 as a whole, it does feel a little bit disparate. It seems like there's three different units. It's going to open with a collection of decrees of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, and then it's going to switch to discussing the synagogue service and the prayer service. It's going to switch to the format of the tikiot, of the blasts, and then at the end, there's going to be this little bit tacked on, a little bit the way we saw it similarly in end of chapter three, that's going to come back to the synagogue service. And it seems like it's out of place, and we're going to have to unpack that and understand it. Similar to chapter 3, it's going to be linked to the end of that chapter. Okay, let's start. So the first four Mishnayot deal with a collection of decrees that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai made post-temple. Now, this is really a literary unit unto itself, and it's very, very beautiful, and I love teaching it. And there's a lot to say about these first four Mishnayot. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is the Nasi. He's one of the leaders of the Jewish people, and he's a really interesting person. It's worth Googling him and seeing different stories. He's the one who was... he was snuck out. They snuck him out of Jerusalem in a coffin when there was a siege on Jerusalem. And the tradition has it that he was brought to Vespasian. And he's the one who asked, "Tein li Yavna v'chachameha, give me Yavna." And he sort of moved the Jewish center to Yavna with the blessing of the Roman general, who then became the emperor. So you should Google that story and look at it. He's also interesting because he's one of the few of our religious leaders, a Nasi, who isn't part of the familial chain of the Gamliels, of Hillel to Gamliel to Gamliel's son to Gamliel to Rabbi Yehuda Nasi. He is a blip in that chain who isn't part of that hierarchy, but studied from Hillel and is a major leader at this critical liminal state pre-destruction, post-destruction, and we're going to see about his leadership. So he's very worth looking more into if you have time. All right, so this unit, four Mishnayot, is going to bring a number of, I think, five of his decrees. Now, he had nine in total, and so we have to think about why these ones are specifically brought here and what they add to our understanding. And it's definitely a good peek into, if you just want to understand something about the composition and the makeup and the structure of Rabbinic Judaism, right? How Rabbinic Judaism survived post-Temple. We're getting like a window into looking at it right now. And it's interesting that it's brought here. The first Mishnah is going to be kind of linked to Rosh Hashanah, and then the last Mishnah is going to be linked to Kiddush HaChodesh. And you sort of have to wonder what these texts are doing here. But overall, what's interesting about putting it in this tractate is we open the tractate, as you know, talking about Kiddush HaChodesh, right, about sanctifying the new moon. And we saw in the second chapter that the moon was referred to as a pregnant moon and a moon that births. And we know from the word Chodesh, Chadash, that it means something new, and that there's in the cycle of the new moon, there's a rebirth and a newness that's brought. And so in some ways, these decrees that we're going to see Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai making is a new, it's a Leida Chadasha of the nation. It's a new birth. It's a renewal of the nation post-destruction. And so from a meta concept, it makes sense to put them here, even besides the small little hooks that are similar in the actual decrees. Okay, let's start reading. So this is chapter 4, Mishnah 1. Yom Tov Shel Rosh Hashanah Shachal Liot B'Shabbat B'Mikdash Hayu Tokim Aval Lo B'Medina. Yom Tov, a good day, the holiday of Rosh Hashanah that fell, that according to the calendar, falls on Shabbat. In the Mikdash, in the temple, right? So temple is not a great word here to translate, even though Mikdash means temple, but you need to understand that the word Mikdash comes from holiness. The place of holiness is the temple, because this word holiness is a word that's going to repeat throughout the whole chapter. In the temple, they would blast, they would blow, but not in the Medinah, not outside the temple, not in the country. And so this is the opening to the chapter and the opening to this first Mishnah. And already the structure of the Mishnah sets up two important juxtaposing themes that the Mishnah wants us to tell about. Now, what's funny about the first line, the holiday of Rosh Hashanah that fell on Shabbat, is I could have easily said the same information by just saying Rosh Hashanah that fell on the Shabbat. Why do I need this word holiday? Why do I need this word Yom Tov? And I'm going to say something here about it, but it's also the word Yom Tov is going to repeat for us later on in the chapter in Mishnah 7. And there it's going to give it a new meaning. So we just should be aware that this word Yom Tov is an interesting word, right? When we say Yom Tov, I think, at least in a traditional context, people think of Pesach, Sukkot, Shavuot, the pilgrimage holidays. And we think of Rosh Hashanah not so much as a Yom Tov, a good day, but as a Yom Nora, Yomim Noraim, Yom Din. These are words that the Mishnah didn't use about it, right? Yom Tov has a more festival sense to it than maybe what we colloquially will think of Rosh Hashanah today. And so we're going to have to think about this word. In this context, what's so interesting about it in the first sentence is it's setting up a juxtaposition. If you physically write out the Mishnah with that sentence, you have Yom Tov on one side and Shabbat on the other end of the sentence, right? Yom Tov Shel Rosh Hashanah Shachal Liot B'Shabbat. So I have Yom Tov versus Shabbat. And then I have B'Mikdash Hayu Tokim V'Lo B'Medina. First word of the second line is temple, countryside. You're missing my hand movements, making the equality. And now I've juxtaposed two things. I have, first of all, a question about holiness and time, like the holiday cycle calendar. And I have a question about holiness and place. And I have those two things juxtaposed one to each other. And that's definitely going to be a topic that's in this chapter. The second thing I see by juxtaposing Yom Tov to Shabbat, and we sort of like have raised this a little bit before in the first chapter, is we know very clearly now, as we've learned the first three chapters, that Yom Tov and the calendar and the lunar cycle is something determined by human beings. Right, human beings in partnership with the divine, but it's human time. We saw that at the end of second chapter with the question of could Is the month sanctified, even if Rabbi Yehoshua didn't think Rabbi Gamaliel's date was the correct date? And Yom Tov is determined by human beings, and Shabbat is determined by the divine, right? Shabbat stems from the Shabbat of creation, of the 7 days that the divine created the world, and then the divine chose to rest. Shabbat happens without any human interaction whatsoever. It will be Shabbat. And so now, once again, this question of juxtaposing humans' determination of time versus godly time, and then juxtaposing the question of holiness in time versus holiness in place. And I think the things in holiness in place, we have a similar idea. The Mikdash is the domain of the divine. That is where the divine chose to reside and have it be the divine's home on earth. That's the way the Torah describes it, the place, Makom Shen. Sheni Shochen et Shmi Sham, the place in which my holy name is going to reside, versus the Medina, which is a human construction where human beings live, is the human space, the human civilization. And so we have these two themes presented to us clearly in the opening sentence of the Mishnah. Okay, so before the destruction of the temple, if Rosh Hashanah falls on Shabbat, they blow a shofar in the temple, but not outside the temple, or not in the Medina. Mishacharav Beit HaMikdash, Hikim Rabbi Yochanan Ben Zakkai, Shiyutukim B'chom Makom Sheyesh Bo Beitim. And now we have an essential line, and this structure is going to repeat itself. From the time of the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, from the House of Holiness, Rabbi Yochanan Ben Zakkai is going to Hidkin. He's going to do an enactment. He's going to do a decree. But the root of the word Hidkin, from the word, we talked about this before, I think, Takana, is to fix. He's going to do a fix. Now, the destruction is definitely a crisis. It is everything is destroyed. You definitely need fixing after destruction. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is going to bring that to the Jewish people. He's going to bring fixing. So when the temple is destroyed, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai does a decree. And what does he decree? He decrees that they would blow the shofar, and you have to add back in, we're talking about on Shabbat, right? Because that was our main topic. You'll blow the shofar on Shabbat. Originally, it was only in the temple. You might think, now there is no temple, we won't be able to blow the shofar on Shabbat. He says, no, you're going to be able to blow the shofar on Shabbat b'chol makom sheyesh bo beitin, in any location that there is a court, that there is a house of judgment. And we have Beit HaMikdash, the house of holiness, juxtaposed with Beit Din, the house of judgment. And before we even understand anything about the laws of Shabbat and the laws of Shofar blowing, we see something radical that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai has done. You might have thought that when the temple is destroyed, I have lost something. Obviously, I've lost something, right? And that loss is some spiritual connection that I can have with the divine in an intimate way that is played out by the rituals that were done in the temple. And you might think, I don't have that anymore. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is saying, no. He's saying some of that, not everything, can be moved. That the spiritual connection, the spiritual center, this closeness that one can achieve with the divine can happen in another location. And the location that he determines, and this is also interesting, is the Beit HaDin, right? We're going to have mention, we had mention in chapter 3 of the synagogue, and we're going to have mention of the synagogue later on in this chapter. But the focus here, and you might have thought that the temple switched to the Beit HaKnesset, but here the Mishnah is saying that the focus is the switch to the Beit HaDin. And I would say Beit HaDin is a representative of Torah, of judgment, but of rulings, right? That's what the court does. The court rules on Torah issues, on interpretation of Torah, on law, etc. And so this is the first sort of radical move that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai does. And we need to unpack it a bit more. So what's going on here? What is the issue with the shofar on Shabbat? Okay. And now there's a lot to say about this, and I'll try to say it in the most clear way. I'm going to give the interpretation of the sources from Eretz Yisrael, from the sources from Israel, i.e. the Tosefta, the Mishnah, the Yerushalmi, and not the way the Babylonian Talmud understands this. So for those who are interested, look at the Babylonian Talmud. They understand this text differently, and I think it's farther from the pshat of the Mishnah. If you look in Midrash VaYikra Rabbah and in the Yerushalmi, they ask the following question. They say, if the mitzvah of blowing shofar is a biblical commandment, as we know it says in the Psukim, then if it's a biblical commandment, why shouldn't it override Shabbat also outside the temple? And if it's not a biblical commandment, then why should I be able to blow it inside the temple on Shabbat, right? They don't understand why there should be a distinction of location, right? If it's biblical, then Hashem says, blow the shofar on Shabbat, right? And yes, I know that there is a midrash, a drasha on the psukim that once it says, in one place it says Zichron Truah, a remembrance of blowing, and in one place it says Yom Truah, a day of blast. And the interpretation is that on Shabbat, it's just a remembrance. But put that to the side for now. Even within that drashat, there seems to be, our Mishnah seems to be saying that in the temple they blew. So why can they blow? And so now there's two possible explanations for why the blowing happened in the temple and then the understanding of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai moving it to the court. And the less radical of what he did is the following. Yes, it's a biblical law. Hashem says, blow the shofar on Rosh Hashanah. And yes, if the divine then makes Rosh Hashanah or people make Rosh Hashanah fall on Shabbat, you should be able to blow the shofar. The problem is I need to be 100% sure today is Rosh Hashanah. And to know 100% sure that today is Rosh Hashanah, because only if it's Rosh Hashanah am I biblically commanded, I need to make sure that the witnesses have come, the month has been sanctified, and once the month has been sanctified, that this is the first of Tishrei, I know 100% it's Rosh Hashanah, and I'll be able to blow. Okay, and that's straightforward. The issue is that I need the witnesses to come, and then once the witnesses to come, like we learned in the first chapter, I need the information to get out to the nation that today is Rosh Hashanah. And so since we know that's difficult, it's only going to be in the Mikdash, right? The court at the time when the temple was standing sat in the temple, right? Which shows that its authority comes from the divine. And so if the witnesses come, then, I say, Mikudash, Mikudash, today is the first day of Tishrei, I've sanctified the month, then it's very easy for me to give the information to the Kohanim in the temple and they can blow the shofar, right? I get the information immediately, almost simultaneously. But any place outside of the temple, maybe I could get it to Rest Yerushalayim, and we're going to see like the Rambam reads the word Mikdash, words the word Mikdash to include all of Yerushalayim. But anywhere outside Yerushalayim, I'm not going to get the information that today is for sure the first day of Tishrei and not the last day of Elul. And so that is why, because of that confusion regarding Kiddush HaChodesh, that I don't have people blow outside. If I could have gotten the information to them immediately, possibly they'd be able to blow. And so there, if that's the case, then once the court moves to Yavna or moves to out of Jerusalem, then Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's decree isn't so radical, right? It makes sense. The place where you know for sure that it's the first of Tishrei and that's wherever the court is going to sanctify the new month, we'll get to blow. A more radical understanding, which is suggested by Shimon bar Yochai in a number of places, is the following, that the reason that they're blowing in the Mikdash is because the psukim say that the shofar should only be blown, should be blown in the Mikdash. You can see it if you look in Bamidbar 29, where it says, Yom Truah Yeh Lechem, a day of blasting you should have for you. And then the next pasuk, but he reads it as all one sentence, Vayasitam, and you should make for yourself a sacrifice, Reach Nichoch Tashem. So, Allah. So that he says in the place where the sacrifices are offered is where you do the day of blasting. And we saw already in chapter 3 that we know that the shofar was blown in the Mikdash. And here too, there are two possible radical reads, one even more radical than the other. If I say that the ritual shofar originally originated in the Mikdash and then Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is moving that to Yavna, that's a pretty radical move. There's some scholars that want to say that based on the Yerushalmi and other places that originally when the Mikdash was standing, that the only place, even on weekdays, not just on Shabbat, the only place that the shofar was blown on Rosh Hashanah was the Mikdash. That there wasn't a mitzvah of shofar that happened everywhere. We talked about in chapter 3 that the chapter 3 already presented the Kohanim blowing versus everyone blowing in sort of a radical equalization of the blowing of shofar. Some people want to read that the decree Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai really is making, which is reflected in chapter 3, is an even more radical decree. When the temple existed, the shofar was only blown weekday or Shabbat on Rosh Hashanah in the temple. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is saying, we don't have the temple, but that can change. We don't have certain parts of the avodah, of the service, but that can be done outside the temple. It can be done in a Beit Din. It can be done in a Beit Din on Shabbat. And the other sort of radical move that he made is, and on weekdays, when Rosh Hashanah falls on a weekday, it could be done anywhere. And that then his move is significantly, significantly more radical. This idea of linking the shofar blowing specifically to the service in the temple, I think we're going to see remnants of it as we learn through this chapter. I already mentioned that we saw it in chapter 3. We're going to see that the blast of the shofar only happened in the musaf service, in the additional service of in the prayer, which is clearly linked to the Korban Ode, and we're going to see it in a few other places. We're going to also see in some of the other decrees that are mentioned in this chapter are decrees that are specifically about ritual ceremonies that happened in the temple and Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai bringing them outside the temple, and then shofar would then fit into that pattern if you read it this way. Okay, we need to get to the end of the Mishnah. The end of the Mishnah brings a machloket. Amar Rabbi Elazar, lo hikid Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai ela biyavna bilvad. Amru lo achad yavna v'achad kol makom sheyesh bo beitin. So Rabbi Elazar, who is from the fourth generation of Tanaim, he's from the generation where the Sanhedrin moves from Yavna up north to Usha and Shfaran. He says something. He said, when Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai made his decree, he only made it in reference to Yavna. He said, if you're going to blow on Shabbos, and it can only happen when the Sanhedrin is, when the high court is in Yavna, i.e. not when it moved to another location, like in the north. Amrulo, the Chachamim, respond to him, Echad Yavna v'chad kol makom sheyesh bo beit din. That it, they're the one and the same. Yavna and any place where there is a Beit Din is one and the same. I can blow the shofar on Shabbat in any location. It's not specific to Yavna. And overall, I think we see here that the issue is that is greater than the question of just technical shofar blowing, but is a question about moving the center of location and moving the spiritual center outside the temple. And can that continuously be moved? Can it be in other places? Just if we understand this machloket, the traditional mafarshim think that Rabbi Elazar is not wanting to limit the issue to Yavna, but that he, they understand him, it's not about Yavna specifically. Some mafarshim say he thinks it's only talking about where there's a Sanhedrin a Gadol, 71, and the Chachamim want even a Sanhedrin Katan, a court of 23. Or some people think he's talking about even minimally the court of 3 that has smicha to be sanctified the new moon. And that the Chachamim were saying, no, even a court of 3 where there are no smuchim, where they're not people who have that have smicha, that have authority or teaching and learning. But any minimal court of 3, regular Joe Shmos, the shofar could be blown. So that's one way to understand this machloket. But I think probably more fitting is to understand that they both know that we're talking about Sanhedrin and Gadol, the court of 71. And the question is really about Yavna versus the Sanhedrin moving to the north. And the Sanhedrin moved to the north after the Bar Kokhba revolt, when the Romans really wanted to detach the Jews from their spiritual center of Yehuda. So we talked about the temple being the spiritual center, and we know that Jerusalem is the spiritual center. But actually the whole area of Judea was considered a place where the Shekhinah resided, where the divine presence resided. And it seems to be that the divine presence is only in Yehuda. And so then when it moves to the north, have we lost it? It sounds like Rabbi Elazar wants to say we've lost it. In fact, specifically for Kiddush HaChodesh, most of the sources say that everyone agrees, even the Chachamim of this Mishnah, that they actually had to create a little Beit Vad in Ein Tav, in a place in Yehuda, because sanctifying the new moon and adding a leap year to the year can only happen in Yehuda with this connection to the divine presence and the partnership between human beings and present and the divine. And so the question here that's under discussion is that specific to the calendar? And Rabbi Elazar says no. Once we move the court away from Yehuda, that sort of sanctity that's within it, that connection to the divine, is broken, and therefore you cannot blow the shofar anymore in the court on Shabbat. And the Chachamim say, no, there is still something in the connection between the court system, the Torah system, and the divine that enables the spiritual connection to happen no matter where it's physically located. We will see eventually in history, not in our Mishnah, that once we lose this court system in Eretz Yisrael, then blowing the shofar in the court is ended. And so even for the Chachamim, there's a link to the land of Israel. In Babel, they don't blow the shofar in the court system. In Babylonia, they've also lost the link of the authorities of the judges, and the whole court system falls apart. Okay, I'm going to pause here, and we are going to continue next time.
Thank you to our Pardes faculty, and thank you to you, our learners. Make sure to check back in at the beginning of each week to stay on track with your Elul learning. And visit www.pardes.org.il for more information about Pardes and our programs.